Hi and welcome back to the shortest history of Britain. In this episode, we take a brief look at the 1400s. As always, we're at war for huge parts of the century as the kingdoms of England and Wales and Scotland edge closer and closer to becoming the Kingdom of Great Britain. We see some massive changes for the three countries and this changeover from the Plantagenet line of kings into the beginning of what would be the Tudor period. So without further ado, let's dive in. At the end of the previous century, we saw the passing of King Richard II and the coronation of the new King of England, Henry Bolingbroke, who would become Henry IV. There was much speculation at the time that Henry had had Richard II murdered or assassinated in order to usurp him and to take the crown for himself. So widespread were the rumours of this that the first thing Henry did as king was to defend himself against such accusations. There was also a popular rumour that Richard wasn't indeed dead at all and that he was being held somewhere while Henry adopted his position. Henry even went as far as displaying Richard's dead body in its casket in St. Paul's Cathedral. That is the old St. Paul's Cathedral, which stood on the same location as the current one, but which was destroyed in the Great Fire of London in 1666. And so this showed that not only was Richard indeed dead, but that he also hadn't met any violent end either, obviously with his body being on show. So this conspiracy would become a trend which beset Henry in the first few years of his reign. He spent much of his time defending himself against plots and schemes and conspiracies brought against him by a wide array of enemies, both domestic and also from abroad. The Welsh Revolt, otherwise known as the Last War of Welsh Independence, would be the final real movement of independence by the Kingdom of Wales before its final incorporation into England. Led by the Prince of Wales, Owain Glyndwr, who was, actually, believe it or not, the last native Welshman to hold the title of Prince of Wales, and this uprising would continue for nearly 15 years in total before it was entirely subdued. Now, as Henry returned from a trip to Scotland, he turned his armies into North Wales to deal with the beginning of this assault, this widespread raiding of England-owned castles there by Owain Glyndwr and his followers. The English army were attacked quite minorly throughout their travels across the land, falling prey to guerrilla tactics of small groups of fighters in the wildlands, and eventually they managed to hold themselves up in the castle of Beaumaris in Anglesey. The rebellion grew both in number and in its power. Much of northern and central Wales, which of course was technically under the law of the English crown, fell back to Owen and to the Welsh. Attacks on English towns were frequent and vicious, and Owen and his men managed to inflict defeat after defeat on the English. When they managed to take Conwy Castle, the English had seen enough. Henry amassed his armies from London and marched them through central Wales. With bases at Shrewsbury and Hereford castles, a furious King Henry powered through the land to reclaim what they saw as theirs. But they failed to engage Owen and his supporters in any real conflict, and when they arrived back at Worcester the following year, they knew that they needed to rethink things. The concern for Henry was that any real uprising may be joined by any of those English supporters who were still loyal to King Richard II, and many of whom believed he was still alive, and that the revolution may grow out of hand. Whilst argument was made that the oppressive laws and regulations against the Welsh were the root cause for this uprising, and that actually relaxing them and negotiating was indeed the way to resolve things, the Lancastrian supporters saw it differently. New anti-Welsh laws were passed, prohibiting Welshmen from buying land in England, from holding any public office in either England or Wales, from bearing arms, from defending a castle or even their home. They stopped any Welsh child from attending education or from becoming an apprentice to a trade, and stopped any Englishman from having a legal claim brought against him by a Welshman. As the war developed, the French began to side with the Welsh, much in the same way they had with the Scottish previously, intending to use the Welsh lands and the Welsh people as tools to enable their war against the English to be more successful. The Welsh dragon grew. Towns and villages, castles, homes, all fell to the Welsh armies. Glamorgan, then Gwent, then the castles at Abergavenny, Cardiff Castle fell, then Newport fell. Welshmen from across England abandoned their homes and their employment and returned back to their homeland to fight for the Welsh cause. Owen took the castles at Aberystwyth and Harlech and drew a parliament there to govern Wales, regarded therein as the prince of that land. He negotiated with Henry's son, who would go on to be Henry V in time, and with the Earl of Northumberland to split the lands of England and Wales between the three of them, and in turn negotiated with the French, who agreed to aid Owen and the Welsh armies in future battles. The English began to take a different approach. Instead of meeting the rebels on the battlefield, Henry of Monmouth, the future Henry V, declared an economic war, blockading the Welsh economy, cutting off trade and the supply of weaponry, using the castles that the English still kept there as their bases for this. One by one, the Welsh lords surrendered, and their Welsh castles began to tumble back to the English. Owen's great castle at Aberystwyth first, then his base at Harlech. Requests were sent to the French and bore no reward. Requests of the Scottish for assistance fell on deaf ears also. And with the revolution just hanging on, in 1413, King Henry IV died. He'd been plagued by illness throughout his life and beset by sickness on many occasions. He even had a skin disease which had disfigured his face, and a young Henry of Monmouth became Henry V, himself actually also wounded to the face after being hit by an arrow in 1403. The new king adopted a far more conciliatory approach to the Welsh uprising, pardoning many of the rebel leaders, including Owen himself, though he was also reluctant to accept this at first. By 1413, the land of Wales was back under English rule. The cost to Wales was massive. The amount of lives lost, the amount of physical destruction, the great toll on the surviving population there, just put this huge added burden on their already quite impoverished existence. Farmland there became wasteland, trade grew to a halt, and it was said that grasses began to grow across the market squares. With the Welsh finally subdued and heavily fined and legislated against to prevent any future uprising, the domestic affairs calmed, and Henry V could, therefore, turn his attentions, as the kings before him had, back to the continent. The Hundred Years' War was technically still going on, and in 1415 we entered into the final phase known as the Lancastrian War. The English dominated the first part of this war, taking great victories across northern France. One of the most famous of the battles there was the Battle of Agincourt in 1415, where 6,000 English troops defeated 25,000 French. One of the decisive factors in the winning of this battle being the extensive use of this English longbow that we've seen before. It was this 6-foot bow of yew or ash wood with a string of flax or hemp, which could launch these arrows a great, great distance. The archers made up as much as 80% of the English force at Agincourt, comprised of this unified army of both English and Welsh warriors. This great longbow could fire as far as 300 metres, it's said, and whilst the arrow wouldn't fully penetrate metal armour, it could go straight through leather, and it could certainly go straight through a leg or a torso, and they were employed to lethally effective force. By August of 1419, the English and Welsh were at the walls of Paris, and the French fell to their knees to negotiate with Henry. After long negotiations, both parties signed the Treaty of Troyes, recognising Henry as regent of France, heir to their throne. He cemented this by marrying Catherine of Valois, the French princess. However, 2 years later, Henry V himself died in France, leaving his successor Henry VI to take the throne. Now, the important point to note here is that the young Henry was merely 2 years old when his father died. A council was drawn again to govern on his behalf until he reached adulthood, and the French did not recognize his title nor claim to their throne, and so this war continued. The management of the war went to Henry V's surviving brother, so the new young king's uncle, John, Duke of Bedford. Another note here, and something we remember as we move onwards through history, when Henry VI was young, his mother, the widow, remarried Owen Tudor, who was a Welsh courtier and a descendant of a very prominent family on the Isle of Anglesey, who'd played a large part in the Wars of Wales in the previous decades, and we'll come back to that a little later, but you may get a clue from his name as to why that's important. The second part of this Lancastrian phase of the Hundred Years' War swung back to French advantage. We saw the rise of characters such as Joan of Arc defending the Kingdom of France, most notably at the Siege of Orléans, and the Crown of France was given back to Charles VI and then on to Charles VII. The war was taking its toll on the country, as indeed it was also on France. From the 1430s, there began a huge economic downturn, which would be known as the Great Slump, this 50-year period of depression caused by the costs of the war and by years of bad harvest and lack of export and import. It was followed shortly afterwards by the Great Bullion Famine too, where there was a significant decrease in the ability to access metals, which spread across the continent, causing a huge downward spike in the construction of everything from tools to weaponry to coin currency, which was all rather a fallout from the Black Death of 1348 too, really. Regardless, or perhaps in spite of, such economic depression, a young Henry VI would go on to make great advancements for our nation. In 1438, to commemorate the victims of the war, Henry and the Archbishop of Canterbury opened All Souls College as part of the University of Oxford. And in 1440, he established and founded Eton College near Windsor, and the following year King's College at what is now the University of Cambridge. Across the border in Scotland, the great King James I of Scotland was assassinated. He'd grown to be a fair ally to the English crown, and the Scottish throne there went to the six-year-old James II. Now, he had troubles from the outset with the powerful Douglas clan, this ancient house of noblemen from the Scottish lowlands. They'd fought in the Wars of Independence with William Wallace and successfully repelled the attacks on the English in Edinburgh Castle in 1400. Archibald Douglas had led a great army of Scots into France to support Charles VII against the English, and had indeed been made Lieutenant General of Joan of Arc's French army. In 1440, his son was brought to King James's castle for dinner, along with his younger brother. Whilst they ate, a bull's head was placed on the table in front of the two brothers, which was this symbol of death at the time. Despite the protests of the young king, the two brothers were dragged outside, faced a mock trial, and were promptly beheaded. The conflict with the Clan Douglas would continue for decades and decades to come, long beyond the reign of James II. Now, back in England, Henry VI was losing most of his properties in France and beyond. In 1453, upon hearing about his final loss in Bordeaux, he suffered a mental breakdown. Becoming unresponsive to everything that was going on around him, an affliction which lasted for more than a year, including also the birth of his own son, Edward. It's believed he may have inherited a genetic condition from his grandfather, Charles VI of France, who did also experience intermittent periods of what was termed insanity during his life too. Around Christmas time of 1454, the king regained his faculties once again. Over the previous few years, a civil war had been brewing between two of the most prominent rival branches of the House of Plantagenet, who were the House of York and the House of Lancaster. Both staked their claims to the throne should King Henry die, and both clearly believed theirs to be the truest cause. Once Henry had regained himself, The war broke out at the Battle of St. Albans, marking the beginning of what was to be known as the War of the Roses, due to the emblems, the two royal badges of these two houses, the White Rose of York and the Red Rose of Lancaster. Henry tried to reconcile their differences, and in 1458 held what was known as Love Day, this purely ritualistic event to bring the two sides together. The negotiations were long and largely fruitless. What advantages were made towards reconciliation didn't really last long at all, and within the year, the fighting continued. At the Battle of Northampton in 1458, the king was captured by the House of York, and several Lancastrians died in their attempts to save him. Though later that year they met again at the Battle of Wakefield, and Richard, Duke of York, head of the House of York, was killed. Richard of York did not, as it was said, give battle in vain, for his side did not drop their swords. Their intentions to capture the crown still stood as strong as before, and the war continued. The following year they met again in the Second Battle of St. Albans, where the captured King Henry was indeed finally rescued by the House of Lancaster. And whilst he did return to the throne for a time, the Yorkists eventually got back to him and locked him in the Tower of London, eventually calling for his death. Whilst the claim is that the king died of melancholy following the news of his own son's death, it's largely suspected that he was murdered somewhere in the Tower, and thus ended the reign and the life of Henry VI. The late Richard of York's son Edward, who had adopted the title of king for a while even when Henry was still alive, was formally crowned King of England and became Edward IV. Edward spent huge sums of money on expensive status symbols to show off his wealth and to highlight his power as the new king. His court was described as being, quote, the most splendid in all of Christendom. He was interested in the intellectual, in scholarship, in history. He bought the finest clothes, which would have featured heavily embroidered shirts and furs from the continent and imported silks from the Ottoman cities of Istanbul or Bursa. He brought expensive jewels, crafted furnishings for his palaces, and a collection of beautifully illuminated literary and historical manuscripts, many also imported from the continent. A few years later in 1476, William Caxton, a writer, established the first printing press in his office in Westminster, and soon became the first English retailer of printed books. Whilst it's not clear where exactly the great library of Edward was actually stored, or exactly what happened to most of the books there, quite incredibly, 40 of Edward IV's books still remain intact and are now kept by the Royal Collection of Manuscripts at the British Library. Edward allied himself with Burgundy, which was then autonomous, and finally set in motion a plan that he'd held for some time to reinvade France, something that of course seemed to be on the bucket list of every ruler our country ever had. In 1475 he left for France with what was said to be the largest army to ever leave England. But the Duke of Burgundy was not prepared, and the French quickly bought out his allegiance. In turn they then offered to buy out the King of England too, agreeing to pay him a huge sum to leave France, followed by yearly payments to stay away. The vast amount of money was able to fund what debts the king had accrued to fund the wars, along with his flamboyant lifestyle, and they started the king on a new path. He began, with his age advancing, to concoct new and increasingly ingenious schemes to raise money, it must be said, not always by legal means. He signed commercial deals with France and with Burgundy, amongst others, and began to use his own ships and those of the English army to trade on his own, importing goods from abroad and imposing tariffs on them for sale. He put an increased focus on law enforcement, especially in Wales. It's for these administrative achievements that Edward is widely remembered, and historians, even from quite a short while afterwards, regarded his reign as one of prosperity and wealth and national success. But Edward was a glutton, both for this flamboyant lifestyle of riches, but also physically for food itself. He would gorge himself, having his cooks prepare huge amounts of food for him at mealtimes. He would then take emetics to cause vomiting and gastric irritation, which would allow him to, in effect, empty himself before gorging once more. This quite disastrous lifestyle soon began to take huge tolls on his health, and it began to fail quite significantly. Around Easter in 1483, he fell fatally ill. Some suggest it could have been caused by pneumonia or even malaria, though the diagnosis of apoplexy caused by this excessive appetite and lifestyle seems to be more fitting in retrospect. Henry died in April of that year. His son, Edward V, was 12 years old at the time of his father's death. As with the young kings of before, a council was drawn to protect him, and Richard of York's son, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, was appointed the boy's protector. This council were keen to secure the young boy's coronation as soon as they could, cementing his place as King of England. But Richard had enough power over him, given so by the previous king, the boy's father, to repeatedly delay the coronation. In June of that year, the renowned cleric Ralph Shah, who had played a part in the War of the Roses, declared that the deceased King Richard IV had indeed been appointed to marry an English noblewoman called Lady Butler, instead of marrying his eventual wife Elizabeth. This meant that the marriage to Elizabeth was not valid, it was not legitimate, and thus nor was the child born to that marriage, the boy marked to be king. The young Edward V, therefore, was never crowned as such. A collection of both nobles and commoners petitioned for the crown to go to Richard, the Duke of Gloucester, and he readily accepted the offer and was crowned King Richard III. By September of that year, a great conspiracy began to form, and murmurs of a civil uprising began to ripple through the land. A band of disaffected gentry and nobles, many loyal to Edward IV, began to form plans to dethrone this new king. The assumed intention had been to replace the young Edward V back on the throne, but the word was spreading that the young boy had indeed been killed, as he had disappeared from public view a few months earlier. They moved, therefore, to bring the exiled Henry Tudor, the grandson of Owen Tudor, who we spoke about a little earlier, back from Brittany, and to crown him King of England. Henry's mother, Margaret, was descended from John of Gaunt, and thus of Edward III, giving her credibility to the line of the throne. The plan was to amass forces at Maidstone and Guildford and to march on London as a feint, drawing the king's attention from the real plan. Meanwhile, forces would march from Devon and from Wales, meeting at Exeter and joining with the returning Henry Tudor. Richard III got word of Henry's arrival and prepared to battle. He rode north to Nottingham and then to Leicester, ready for the fight. The Yorkist army of the king positioned themselves on a great ridgeline at Bosworth Field, archers and cannons and infantry lined from east to west, some 10,000 to 12,000 men strong. Henry's army was not quite so big, perhaps 6,000 or 7,000 men, a gathering of not only English rebels, but the Welsh and the Scottish, and also the French too. Now, the traditional way to do battle was to break an army into three forces, known as the vanguard at the front, the centre, clearly in the centre, and then the rearguard behind. Though seeing this vast force of the king up on the ridgeline, the decision was made to keep the entire army of Henry Tudor as one, flanked on the outsides by the horsemen. The first wave of the battle went to the king, raining arrows down on the men below, adding cannon fire too as they negotiated their way to the hill through the marshy land of Bosworth. But then they came to hand-to-hand combat, and Henry's men got the upper hand. During the battle, and with his side on the defensive, the king saw Henry Tudor at the rear of the pack and decided to try to end the battle quickly by taking, or indeed killing, the enemy commander. He rode a small group across the battlefield into the enemy ranks to find Henry Tudor. Henry's men rallied around him, and the king's small band of riders was pressed back, causing Richard's horse to topple into a marsh, throwing off its rider. King Richard, now on foot, was surrounded. Richard refused to retreat, reportedly claiming, and I quote, "God forbid that I retreat one step. I will either win this battle as king or I will die as one. The Yorkist men took that opportunity, killing Richard where he stood, striking him with such power that his helmet was driven into his head. Henry seized the crown by conquest, and in October of 1485 was crowned Henry VII, King of England, and began the line of Tudor kings who would go on to hold the throne of England. Henry married Elizabeth of York, thus unifying the previously warring factions and bringing together the houses of Lancaster and York, thus ending the War of the Roses. Henry's throne, however, was far from secure. Many supporters of Richard and of the House of York, who'd seen this recent conquest change the regime in England, believed that the result at the Battle of Bosworth Field was far from final, and that such things could be easily reversed under certain circumstances. Henry's policy as king, at least initially, was to maintain peace in the land and to create more prosperity and economic wealth. He'd been under the financial and physical protection of France for most of his life, and he signed a treaty with them that would secure money for the English purse while keeping any French suitors for the English throne well at bay. He also massively subsidised shipbuilding too, strengthening the English ability to trade internationally. He also commissioned Europe's first and the world's oldest surviving dry dock at Portsmouth. Henry VII was also one of the first European monarchs to recognise the newly founded Kingdom of Spain, and he married off his son Arthur, Prince of Wales, to one Catherine of Aragon, a name we'll hear again in due course. He also signed the Treaty of Perpetual Peace with King James IV of Scotland, the first English-Scottish treaty in nearly 200 years, although its aims of ending the seemingly endless wars between the two nations did ultimately fail, though we jumped the end of the 1400s there, as this treaty was actually signed in 1502, so we'll step back a little bit here. Henry was one of the first kings who'd come to the throne with little or no experience in managing an estate or any real finances, but he proved himself fiscally prudent and a fine financial manager. But big problems were afoot for the king, and the fine and profitable end of the 1400s would soon lead into a new period of British history, and the rise of one of the most extravagant and radical kings to have ever reigned, whilst the Scottish uprising would see a power like never before. Next time, the roller coaster of King Henry VIII, Bloody Mary, the Queen of the North, and the emergence of Mary, Queen of Scots, and a shift to global domination with Queen Elizabeth I. Thank you.